of Iceland, which includes Julia Bradbury's Icelandic Walk this very evening at 8 o'clock on BBC 4 television. Well, this is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news from Ian Skelly.
Former senior military leaders have welcomed the news that the government is preparing to put the military covenant, which promises a duty of care to the armed forces, on a legal footing for the first time. The Defence Minister, Andrew Robotham, has indicated that there will be legal changes to ensure service personnel and their families are rewarded for their sacrifices. A formal announcement is expected on Monday. Colonel Richard Kemp, a former senior commander in Afghanistan, said the move would be a huge morale boost for the troops. Police in eastern Afghanistan have opened fire on a demonstration by hundreds of people protesting against the accidental killing of a teenager by NATO-led forces. A provincial official said police shot one protester dead and wounded three others after some started firing weapons. Syria says soldiers and tanks are being pulled out of two cities, including Deraa in the south, the crucible of the anti-government protests. It follows operations to restore government control there. The authorities in Iran have delayed the punishment of a man who was due to be blinded with acid. Majid Mohavdi admitted throwing acid into the face of a woman who'd refused to marry him. He was sentenced under the Sharia system of retributive justice, but the case prompted a protest from human rights campaigners. The Foreign Office has said its consul on the Spanish island of Tenerife is helping the family of a British woman murdered in an apparently random attack yesterday. The Spanish authorities say a 28-year-old Bulgarian man ran into a shop and attacked the woman with a knife, decapitating her. Japan has completed the shutdown of a nuclear power station amid fears that it's vulnerable to natural disasters. The aging Hamaoka plant sits on a fault line where scientists say a major earthquake is 87% likely in the next 30 years. It'll be closed for several years to allow safety improvements. And the weather for this afternoon: showers will progress southeastwards throughout the afternoon. They'll be heaviest on the east coast, where there's a risk of thunder. The southwest should remain dry. And that's the BBC News and the weather. The time now, 2.5 minutes past one.
And here's the first of this weekend's early music shows, presented by Catherine Bott.
Music by Monteverdi from the first commercial recording by the choir, founded by today's very special guest on the Early Music Show. The choir, of course, is the Monteverdi Choir, and my guest is Sir John Eliot Gardner. John Eliot, tell me about this piece of Monteverdi on vinyl.
Well, it was recorded by Harry Mudd and his dog. Harry Mudd ran Abbey Records, and he issued it in stereo, but I'm convinced it's a mono recording. And we recorded it in the Coat Hall at Bradston, where I was at school. And the choir at that stage was composed largely of King's and John's choral scholars, James Bowman as well, who wasn't a King's choral scholar. It had all the King singers, Brian Kay and Simon Carrington and all that lot, Felicity Palmer singing soprano. It was probably a pretty awful cacophony, but we really, really tried to get into the spirit of Monteverdi's colour world, and I apologise for the quality of the recording.
Was it, at that stage, just an exciting one-off, or did you plan from the beginning to have the brand Monteverdi Choir to be as long-lasting as it has been, 45 years?
Hadn't a clue, no. All I was doing, really, was to say, how can one possibly interpret this glorious music of the 17th century, Italian and multicoloured and so passionate, using just the rather sad and beige-coloured voices that were serving English music at the time and may have been appropriate for English music. I'm not even sure it was very good for that, but certainly weren't right or appropriate for Monteverdi. So it was a question of taking extremely good musicians, grouping them together, excellent voices, but who were using only maybe just a tiny fraction of the palette of colours that they were capable of expressing.
Well, in today's programme, we and you have jointly chosen music to reflect almost all aspects of your long-running and exciting career. So we're going to go to another composer now who I know means a lot to you, and that's Purcell. This is part of Purcell's Music for the Funeral of Queen Mary with the Monteverdi Choir.
Thank you.
Now, the Monteverdi Choir was followed by the Monteverdi Orchestra.
It was indeed.
Which was not a period instrument, perhaps.
No, it wasn't. It was a crack chamber orchestra formed of really, really top London chamber orchestral players and quartet players. First of all, they loved the choir, the sound the choir made. Secondly, they had a very open mind when it came to the style of instrumental playing that was appropriate for late 17th century, 18th century music. I mean, we're talking now in the late 60s, where the early music movement was really still in its infancy. What they did, which was brilliant, was to move right up to the wire with me, to the point where, before a rehearsal, I would go off to visit Emmanuel Herbitz, in Golders Green. He would then scrabble under his bed and find boxes of most wonderful transitional bows. He would hike them out from under the bed, hand them to me, go off to the rehearsal, hand them out to the players, and they would experiment with them, sometimes with gut strings, but sometimes on normal strings. And some of our first concerts and recordings of Monteverdi, of Purcell, of Handel were done in that way. And then they were collected up and taken back and shoved under the bed again. The thing with the Monteverdi Orchestra was that even despite Manny Herbert's generosity with the allocation of bows and so on, we came up against a brick wall stylistically. And it happened with Rameau. It didn't happen so much in Bach, it didn't happen with Handel, it didn't happen in Purcell, but it did happen with Rameau, that his use of wind instruments is so, so particular and so obviously French. If you try and play a Rameau with a modern orchestra, you're distorting the palette of sounds. You can't get what Debussy calls timbre varié, all the sort of nuances and subtleties of instrumental timbre that you can get with period instruments. And I was faced with this horrendous choice because I was devoted to this orchestra and they were rather devoted to me, and we got on terribly well. And I had to disband them in 1977 and 78 and form the English Baroque Soloists. And I was a bit Johnny-come-lately because, you know, at that stage there were many other extremely accomplished harpsichord directors like Chris Hogwood, like Trevor Pinnock, who had started their own groups. I was a skeptic, frankly, because I thought, yes, this is a lovely sound world, this is interesting, but the technical accomplishments at that point, not later, at that point, were embarrassingly low. There were too many squawks and squeaks and errors. And not just that, there was a sort of mannerism and exaggeration in the way the phrases were constructed, which is all to do with pioneers. Pioneers do that. They exaggerate for effect, and then it gradually calms down and everybody accepts and is grateful for the results of their research. And I wasn't prepared to make that leap initially, and then I did. I took the plunge. And I had a very angry choir on my hands. They said, how could you do that? You've betrayed us. You've disbanded a wonderful orchestra. You've got all these vegetarian squeaks and squawks. They can't play in tune, they bulge, they're incompetent, and they contest our presence, they contest your presence, which they did, I have to say. They weren't interested in a conductor, they weren't interested in playing with a choir, they were interested in doing their own thing. And it was quite an uncomfortable couple of years, and then we got going. And I suppose the thing that got us going together and broke through the sort of barrier of mistrust and scepticism was, again, Rameau, because they hadn't played any Rameau before. I had. I knew about Nozze Negal. I knew about swinging rhythms, bluesy rhythms. I knew about the textures and so on. And gradually, they took it on board. And we were lucky enough to get 2 years of exposure to Rameau, intensive exposure, thanks to the Festival of Aix-en-Provence. And in 1982, we did his magnum opus, Les Boreades, which the French didn't know. Nobody knew because it hadn't been done. And this particular piece, I think, is pure enchantment. It's L'Entrée de Polyhymnie, Entry of Polyhymnia, the Muse. And it's got all that sort of languid sensuality and myriad of colours that are sort of almost liquid in their substance or lack of substance. And it just sums it all up to me.
Well, George Malcolm said, "You must look at Rameau," and there was John Elliott Gardiner with the English Baroque soloists, proving that that's absolutely right, isn't it, John Elliott? We have to look at Rameau. We cannot ignore him.
Absolutely. I always think that he's a bit eclipsed by Lully, who preceded him.
Well, we're going to come back to Monteverdi, because it's the Monteverdi Choir, and for a short but obviously very productive time, the Monteverdi Orchestra, succeeded by the English Baroque soloists. And the key work that studs your career, right from Cambridge to, I would imagine, a lot of performances in 2010, is his Vespers of 1610. We're going to hear from the second recording, which has among its bass lineup a very young Bryn Terwyl.
Yes, that's right. The performance and the recording that took place in Venice was a type of homecoming. I, unrepentant in believing that Monteverdi composed this music with a view to the job in Venice. He wrote it while he was still in Mantua, but it seems to me so obvious from the structure of the piece, from the flavour of it, from its orientalism, from its extravagance and opulence, that it's slanted towards the Basilica di San Marco. And all I can say is, in practice, and I've done it now 5 or 6 times in San Marco, it fits like a glove in that building in terms of the matching of instrumental and musical timbres to the mosaics, to the cupolas, to the Byzantine feel of the place, to the geographical layout of the organisation of the building. There's scholars who dispute that, who deconstruct the piece, who take it apart, who put in lots of plain song, which I feel weakens it and dilutes it. There's some people who change the order. There's some people who transpose it. I just love it as it is, as it came down to us in Amandino's print of 1610. And I think you've chosen Lauda Jerusalem. It's very high, it's very exciting, and it's got a kind of sneeze factor. The excitement sort of builds up that you feel it's going to explode into a sneeze at the end. I absolutely adore it.
Thank you.
The Lauda Jerusalem from Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, John Eliot Gardner conducting the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque soloists. That's a very theatrical work. This theatricality really seems to chime with your whole career. You're an opera man. I mean, so, of course, was Monteverdi. You obviously love being in the pit.
I do.
And we're going to hear some Gluck now. Iphigénie en Tauride.
This is a great opera. I really believe it. Gluck, to me, is a slightly lesser talent than Rameau, but a key figure in the history of music and a very moving figure because he combines in a very, very persuasive way the lyricism of Italian opera, which, of course, can go right back to Monteverdi and goes on to Mozart, with a very French sensibility that he acquired when he was composing here in the 1770s. It was actually the first opera I ever conducted at Covent Garden in 1973 with Senor Jurinac in the title role, lovely lady, and Robert Massard as Oreste. And it was also the first opera I conducted at Lyon when I was appointed music director in Lyon in 1982. And we recorded it with Diana Montague in the title role. She sang beautifully. And Tom Allen as Oreste. I think it's in its economical way, the use of orchestral sonorities and the combination of this Italian and French palette of sounds, I think it's very persuasive.
Thank you.
Diana Montague singing an aria from Gluck's Iphigénie en Tauride, with John Elliott Gardner conducting the Orchestre de l'Opéra de Lyon. Now, John Elliott, you had a very busy time in the 80s, because not only for 5 years were you music director at the opera in Lyon, but you were also, throughout the decade, directing the Göttingen Handel Festival. How did you make that work?
It was a very, very, very busy and very fruitful time. Yes, the Handel Festival in Göttingen was something quite different, because it was again Coles to Newcastle, but this time to Germany, where Handel has always been looked on askance because he left Germany for England and then wrote Italian operas and English oratorios. What was a good Saxon doing that for? In Germany, and particularly at Göttingen, which is the central sort of mecca of Handel performance, there was a long tradition of Germanizing, of Teutonifying Handel's music, of turning the Italian operas into German operas, and of turning all the English oratorios, dramatic oratorios, into German pieces with changes of plot. I mean, in the Nazi time, for instance, Israel and Egypt became the Mongol horde. All the castrato parts or the alto parts were transposed down for baritone in the operas. Everything was done in German. The orchestrations were beefed up, thickened. So that when we pitched up in 1981 and started doing Messiah and Alexander's Feast, Israel and Egypt, Jephthah, Semele, Saul, in English, on period instruments, it was a huge shock to German sensibilities. They did come round to it, and they were very warm in their response. But it was a 10-year, very intensive block of work of rehabilitation and re-education in a way.
Well, we're going to hear a duet from Saul, which is an extraordinary achievement for orchestral writing, isn't it? I mean, really pioneered.
It's the biggest orchestra you ever wrote for, yes.
The story of Saul is a dark one. There are magic forces involved, and he really exploits all sorts of orchestral things that nobody had ever thought of before.
At the time, they were saying, oh, the maggots have got into Handel's head once more.
But this duet, which Lynn Dawson sings with Derek Lee Reagan, O Fairest of 10,000 Fair, you can tell from the title, this is just vocal beauty. Thank you. Lynn Dawson and Derek Lee Regan in a beautiful duet from Handel's oratorio Saul with the English Baroque soloists, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. You had a pretty Lutheran year yourself in the year 2000. It's very well documented, your Bach cantata pilgrimage. Now we're going to play the opening chorus of cantata number 20, or Ewigkeit du Donnerwort.
That's amazing.
Where was that recorded?
That was recorded at St Giles Cripplegate in London on the first Sunday after Trinity, June 2000. I find this an overwhelming piece. Bach is absolutely at his best when he's dealing with issues of life, death and eternity. And this is Armageddon. This is what happens at the Day of Judgment. He's not beyond taking his listeners, his congregation, by the scruff of the neck and saying, listen out to this. This is what's in store for you. I mean, depends on your opinion whether you think Bach is essentially a preacher or whether he's a musical commentator acting in counterpoint, in a way, to the liturgy and to the spoken word. To me, he's a humanist and a dramatist, and he brings this superbly to life.
The opening chorus of Bach's Cantata No. 20, with John Eliot Gardner conducting the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque soloists, recorded in the Church of St Giles Cripplegate in the City of London in June 2000. And John Eliot, 11 years later, you do seem to have an absolutely encyclopedic memory for where you did everything and when.
That whole experience marked my life very, very strongly, and I think it marked the lives of pretty well all the musicians who took part in it in different segments of the pilgrimage. It's not every day that you get to spend time with a single composer and in exclusive confinement with a single composer, and not that many composers one would want to do that with. But with Bach, I never regretted a day of it. I was overwhelmed by the amount of music I had to learn and to come to terms with and to impart my love of it to a very receptive group of singers and players who supported me all through, and collectively to impart that to audiences of very, very different persuasions, denominations, nationalities and so on. I mean, when you think that we started in Germany and ended up in New York and took in the north of Scotland, Rome, Santiago de Compostela, Saint-Denis on the night that France won the European Cup, and we had to finish just on time, although there were so many klaxons outside, it would have completely ruined the concert and the recording.
And then in 2004, you did another one.
This was a much more seasoned, well-honed pilgrimage route, that to Compostela. That was a wonderful experience. I mean, we started off in the middle of France, near the Auvergne, right on the French pilgrimage route to Compostela. And we performed in wonderful churches in Rodez, in Conques, in Locdieu. We set up camp, as it were, in a beautiful former priory, and we rehearsed there. And we did something like 18 concerts in 25 days, and we were unable to walk all the way, obviously, but what we did every day was to sing a concert in a different church, some tiny, some medium-sized, and some huge, like Leon Cathedral, like Compostela, Santiago itself.
And this, I think I'm right in saying, was a purely a cappella.
It was me and a tuning fork and 24 singers.
Yes, back to basics.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, the piece we're going to hear, Nessien's Mater by Mouton, was that
heavenly
part of the programme?
Jean Mouton, who's a French-Flemish composer, and Nessien's Mater is a piece of double choir polyphony in canon at the interval of a fourth at the distance of a bar and a half.
Wow.
Amazing.
You don't have to know that to enjoy it.
You don't.
But it's really exciting.
He doesn't make a tra-la-la of his learning, but that's actually what he's achieving.
Thank you.
Nessien's Mater by Mouton, sung by the Monteverdi Choir. Present also, John Eliot Gardner and his tuning fork on the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela. John Eliot, I'm realising we've only had in this whole programme one purely instrumental piece. And of course, in a way, that's a way of celebrating the fact that you began with a choir.
Still have.
And you still have it 45 years later. But in 1990, you founded your revolutionary and romantic orchestra.
And I must say, I'm having a ball at the moment because the opera I'm conducting here at the Opéra Comique is Le Freischütz. Le Freischütz. Weber wrote it, of course, for performance in Germany, in
Dresden. Der Freischütz.
Der Freischütz, yeah. Absolutely. But it's something of a wonderful European omnium gatherum of influences. The lyrical lines are often Italian. The structure of the piece is French opéra comique. It's full of German folklore. It's a pivotal work to me. It looks back on the late 18th century. It takes over from where Mozart left off in The Magic Flute. It takes on board what Beethoven is doing in Fidelio, and it looks forward absolutely to the Trojans and to the damnation of Faust of Berlioz.
Well, we can all look forward to that at the proms in September. But we're going to play out with something that, conveniently for us now, you have already recorded music from another Weber opera inspired perhaps by English literature. It's Oberon.
Absolutely.
And we're going to hear the finale with Jonas Kaufmann playing a character who doesn't seem to crop up in Shakespeare.
Huon, yes. Huon. Well, he's a medieval French knight.
And the Monteverdi Choir, the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique, and John Eliot Gardner conducting. Before we go into it, may I thank you for sparing us time here on a spring day in Paris.
Great pleasure.
At the end of your run of Freischütz. And tell me what we should listen out for in this finale of Oberon.
Oh, just the glories of Weber's exuberant orchestration, his wonderful combination of voices and orchestra. Every bit Mozart's successor, and he's every bit the precursor of Schumann and of Wagner and of Berlioz.
Oh,
finale of Weber's opera Oberon with Jonas Kaufmann, the Monteverdi Choir and the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique, conducted by Sir John Elliot Gardner. Today's Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott and produced in Manchester by Les Pratt. And on tomorrow's programme, Lucy Skeeping will be introducing a concert of Vivaldi motets and Handel concertos given in northern Spain. Do join us for that at the usual time, just after the 1 o'clock news. This is BBC Radio 3. Now another chance to hear the lunchtime concert, which was first broadcast live from Wigmore Hall last Monday. It's presented by Louise Fryer.
American cellist Alisa Weilerstein may only be in her 20s, but she's racked up some pretty impressive achievements. As well as performing with orchestras across the states, she's just completed a 14-day tour with the St. Petersburg Philharmonic. Last year, she played Elgar's cello concerto with, among others, the Berlin Phil under Daniel Barenboim. And in 2009, she performed at the White House and was soloist in Dvorak's cello concerto with the Simón Bolívar Symphony Orchestra, Gustavo Dudamel, the conductor. She performed in Buenos Aires and was invited straight back to Argentina to give a series of concerts conducted by her brother, Joshua Weilerstein. So it's perhaps not surprising that her concert today starts with a piece by an Argentine composer, Osvaldo Golijov, before Alisa plays Bach's first solo cello suite, and she'll end with a solo cello sonata by Kodály. Golijov, who's of Eastern European Jewish heritage, was born in La Plata in Argentina in 1960. He lived for a few years in Israel. These days, he's based in the US, studying with, among others, George Crumb and Oliver Nussen. But Argentine tango is the focus of this first piece, Omar Amor, a fantasy on my beloved Buenos Aires, a song forever associated by the Argentine people with the legendary tango singer Carlos Gardel, who was killed in a plane crash in 1935 at the very height of his fame. The words of the song are inscribed on Golijov's score. The day I'll see you again, my beloved Buenos Aires, oblivion will end, there'll be no more pain. After the Golijov, which requires the C string to be tuned to a B natural, Alisa will take a brief moment to retune before moving into a core work in any cellist's repertoire, Bach's Solo Cello Suite No. 1 in G major, the first of six Bach composed for one of the accomplished cellists at Curtin around about 1720. As with each of the six suites, this one is made up of five dance movements, an allemande, a courante, a sarabande, a pair of minuets and a gigue after an opening prelude. And here to perform Bach and first Omar Amor by Osvaldo Golijov comes the cellist Alisa Weilerstein.